Chapter 31, Calendar, 1954. It was 1954, and in the United States, officials anxiously awaited the results of a large trial of Jonas Salk's injected polio vaccine. Since the end of the war, cases of paralysis and other mysterious illnesses had exploded each summer, and doctors and parents alike were pleading for help. After several false starts, Salk's vaccine appeared to show promise, and so over 600,000 school children had been recruited into the most highly anticipated clinical trial ever run. Fear of smallpox had nearly vanished as the virus had weakened naturally to a shadow of its former self. The triple combo DTP shot remained popular, and most children would continue to get three injections as babies. In Canada, the Dion quintuplets had come of age. A few years earlier, they had set off by train to meet the Queen of England in New York. The press seemed more interested in the 16-year-old girls than the Queen, their every move attended by the pop of flashing bulbs and throngs of adoring fans. A huge delegation accompanied the Quints, their entire family, 15 students, 3 nuns, and a nurse for Emily, whose epileptic attacks had continued. When it came time for the girls to meet the Queen, their siblings were turned away at the stateroom door. The meeting was for the Quints and their parents, and no others. The girls were horrified as they knew their siblings' hatred for them would multiply, a sentiment likely to be echoed by their parents. Back in Calendar, the girls wanted nothing more than to get away from their unloving mother and father. Their high school graduation, like every other event of their lives, was a staged affair. The basement of their home was festooned with drapes as the robed quintuplets made their way to receive their diplomas. With mortarboards, a bouquet of flowers, and picture-perfect smiles refined over thousands of other photographs, the girls posed again for the world to see, their lives a conjured invention of happiness only they knew for the fantasy it was. Even after the ceremony, their father was reluctant to allow them to leave. He knew that once the girls separated, the Dion quintuplets would no longer exist. Alone, they were just 5 ordinary girls with ordinary dreams. The photographs and endorsements would disappear and the money would dry up. With their retirement from public life, an event they all dreamed of, Oliver Dion, their father, would be out of a job. Marie was the first to leave the Dion home, but after a brief stay at a convent, let her sisters know she couldn't handle the rigors of being apart from them. It was an ordeal none of them felt prepared for, and so Emily took off by bus to retrieve her. On the way, she became disoriented, got lost, and ended up spending the night in the Quebec police station. The event, widely covered in the press, humiliated her father and only increased public speculation that something was wrong with her. Given her notoriety, the police drove Emily directly to where Marie was staying, where they enjoyed a brief reunion. Once their father and other sisters arrived to pick them up, Emily let them know she had decided that she too desired a life of seclusion and service as a nun. She had never fancied being married, and the prospect of a regimented life with a new sisterhood gave her comfort. She said her goodbyes to Marie, Yvonne, Annette, and Cecile. Emily would not be going home. A few weeks later, the phone rang at the Dion household. Upstairs, the girls were in their bedroom listening to music. Their father walked in and turned off the radio. Their mother, her face drained of all color, took a moment, then said, "Take hold of yourselves. The nuns telephoned. Emily has died." It was a seizure, the kind Emily had suffered hundreds of times before. In the presence of her sisters or nurses, there was little risk. They had a wooden spoon they would place in her mouth to keep her from biting her tongue and would turn her over to make sure she could breathe. At the convent, she had been left alone, a circumstance she had never before experienced. When the inevitable attack came, Emily had no help. Thrashing wildly, she would end up turned over, face down in her bed. She had suffocated. Her sisters and the world were stunned. A few days later, her funeral was held at their home. Thousands came from afar to mourn her passing, their faces pressed against the fences that surrounded their property, just as they had done years earlier as 5 little girls traipsed around the playground at the Defoe nursery. A touched Oliver Dion decided to open the gates of his home, allowing the public to file through his house and pay tribute to the passing of his daughter. Even in death, the cameras were there as the girls posed together one last time. On this occasion, and probably for the first time in their lives, they were not dressed identically. Marie, Yvonne, Annette, and Cecile were dressed in black and surrounded Emily, who lay in her casket in a simple blue gown. The camera bulbs would flash again, but the Dionne quintuplets were no more. In Forest, Mississippi, Donald Triplett had graduated from high school. His years on the farm seemed to have given him the freedom to develop into a young man his parents likely thought impossible given his early delinquencies. His delayed entry put him a few years behind schedule, but he was able to enjoy his time at Forest High, excelling at math, joining the Future Farmers of America, even being a featured performer in a play called The Monkey's Uncle. Although the quirks and peculiarities remained, he was no longer, quote, hopelessly insane, as his mother had confessed in a letter to Connor years earlier. He went on to attend Millsaps College and was even able to join a fraternity. But Connor's first mention of Donald Triplett and autism years earlier was still a befitting diagnosis. Those who knew him were able to bond with him in a way he was unable to reciprocate. Results had come back from the 600,000 children who took part in the polio vaccine trial, and they appeared promising, so encouraging that the Salk vaccine was rushed into widespread production. In their haste to make the polio shot, mistakes were made, and in an echo of earlier diphtheria disasters, the initial rollout in 1955 was a catastrophe. The virus contained in some of the vaccines was not properly inactivated, and as a result, 40,000 children were sickened with polio. Unfortunately, nearly 200 were paralyzed, 10 were killed, and the vaccine was reluctantly pulled from the shelves. The public had taken years to recover from the horrors of the early diphtheria shots, and many would opt to wait for Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine years later in 1961, rather than risk paralysis or death for their children. The doctors administering the injections, however, were confident as ever. They were told by public health officials the vaccines were safe, and they believed them. For the diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis injections, the aluminum they contained had been tested in the 1930s on children, many of them institutionalized, the first and last time such a test had been conducted. As Donald began life on his own at Millsaps College, the New York Times, who like most other newspapers had run thousands of articles on the quintuplets over the years, tracking their every milestone, ran their final article on Emily Dionne. Just a few miles away, doctors at the Psychiatric Institute in New York City had made an interesting, if not disturbing, discovery. They were experimenting with rhesus monkeys and realized that by putting a particular substance on their brains, they could induce a debilitating neurological condition. The substance? Aluminum hydroxide, the same ingredient contained in the diphtheria vaccines Emily received as a child. The condition? Epilepsy, the disorder which had killed her.